Hey, we're back on Downtown. It's 4:32 on a Wednesday afternoon. Rich Kimble here, along with Bruce Pratts, Don Cookson, and it's time for Sports Lit 101. Today we talk about a book that we discussed a couple of weeks ago on the program. We're happy to have the author here today. He's written a number of books, including Castro's Curveball, Red Rain, and nonfiction works like High Heat and Summer of 68, the season that changed baseball and America forever. His newest is a work of fiction. It is terrific, called Escape from Castro's Cuba. We are thrilled to be joined by Tim Wendel. Tim, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure, guys.
We both love your book so much, and as I was telling you before we came on, we're doing it backwards. Bruce and I have read this, and now we've got to go back and read the prequel.
Very much, yeah. Castro's Curveball is where Billy Bryan's story and all the intrigue starts in Cuba, and it kind of goes back to my first trip down to the island in 1992, where I had heard potentially before going down that Fidel Castro could have maybe played baseball, but then to hear it from Cubans, to actually realize a young Fidel was at the crossroads between baseball and politics and revolution at one point in his life, kind of turned my head, and that's certainly the backdrop for the first one.
Well, for a book like this to work, you got to be very knowledgeable about at least two things. One is baseball, and we know that you've got the track record for that, but also Cuba, and clearly your time there paid off because you really bring it to life in such a powerful way.
Oh, thank you very much. I think I was fortunate on several of the trips, and certainly fortunate just to talk to the Cuban people that I've done on my four trips down there. It's funny because, you know, what's a gringo like me, so to speak, writing about Cuba? I mean, I grew up in upstate New York. What am I doing writing about Havana? But I still remember that first trip, and I was covering some ball games before the Barcelona Summer Olympics for USA Today, and we went. It was a series of games between the U.S. team and the Cuban national team, and it was on the eastern end of the island, and they didn't have a press box, so they sat us all in the stands, and this includes Dan Le Batard and Howard French, who worked for Associated Press, etc. And I was on the edge, and this is like one of those serendipity moments, where how it changes your life, and I was sitting on the end of the row, and about halfway through the game, this Cuban gentleman, older gentleman, came up to me and said, "Tell me about the Minnesota Twins." And of course, the Minnesota Twins had won in 1991. I had covered that World Series. And I kind of started a little bit into my sports talk radio thing. Oh, it'll be difficult for them to repeat. They don't have a big budget. You know, there's better teams in the division. And he said, "I know all that." And I went, "Okay, what do you need to know?" And he said, "What do they look like?" And in a sense, they're so cut off from the rest of the world that they know the players, but they can't recognize them. So I went around the diamond, Kent Herbeck at first, Jack Morris on the mound, Kirby Puckett finished with him in center field, who's difficult enough to explain in English, you know, let alone my Spanglish, you know, and I'm like looking for these words. I'm trying to describe Kirby Puckett, and I'm looking out on the field. And when I finished, I turned to this gentleman and just said, "There you go. There's your 1991 World Series champion Minnesota Twins." And he had tears starting to run down his face. And I remember thinking at that point, man, I'm in a weird, strange part of the world. And my friends tease me sometimes that what Hemingway had the old man in the sea, I had the old man in the ballpark.
Hey, Tim, this is Bruce. 55 years ago when I was in prep school, I had a dorm master named Melvin Arona, who had, with his family, escaped from Cuba. I never knew anybody in the world who liked baseball as a concept and a game more. He didn't care what game he was watching. It could be a JV game at the prep school. It could be a game on television. And he always said to me that baseball was made for the Cuban people. And he would go on to explain that it was something about that was one of the greatest gifts to Cuba was baseball. Does that sound like an overstatement on his part, or is that the kind of attitude you ran into?
No, Bruce, I think it's pretty legit. It's what I ran into, and I think it tracks on a couple levels. Number one, they've been playing the game in Cuba almost as long as we have. You know, right. It's a national pastime, obviously, in the U.S., but here it's a game of, almost too traditional in some ways. You know, some people say it's too slow. It's mom's apple pie. It's 4th of July. Whereas the way it got its start in Cuba well over a century ago, too, it was the game of an independent Cuba. Mm-hmm. If you didn't want to go, you know, even before the Spanish-American War to the, say, the bullfights, you went out in the jungle and played this radical new game called baseball. And that's, it got into its the country's soul that way. It's been a huge part of its history. And unfortunately, some people like Fidel Castro, being the major example, have played that to their advantage. One of the things that Castro did, which was very sharp politically after he took power in 1959, is after he seized power, one of the first things he did was tour the island, barnstorm the island with a baseball team he had put together. Now, of course, Castro pitched. He was always going to pitch, the egomaniac. But he had, like, Che Guevara playing second base. Yeah. He stunk. And people loved it. They just went, wow, you know, we finally got somebody who's playing our game. And even talking to the Cubans as recently as, oh, the 2017 visit I made or the 2000, they said, this is one of the things that kept this guy in power. He knew how much we loved baseball.
Well, one of the things that I think is outstanding about your book, and I say this as both a writer and someone who loves really good writing, is it's not only character-driven, but as our friend who's off on the show, Colin Fleming, who's with us every week, mentioned yesterday, great fiction is where characters are forced to make choices. Mm-hmm. And man, oh man, are the characters in this book often forced to make choices. And I thought that kept a narrative tension of just the highest order. And I realize we haven't read the first book in this. But how do you keep so many of them juggled in the air?
Prayer.
Yeah, note cards.
Yeah, note cards, a lot of index cards. One of the things I do is I have conversations with my characters, and they're often out loud. We they're almost like interview sessions. And one of the trepidations I had in doing the sequel, even though it stands on its own, An Escape from Castro's Cuba after Castro's Curveball, was, are these guys still going to talk to me? And the biggest trepidation, I've got a first-person narrator, a washed-up catcher in the Washington Senators organization named Billy Bryan. Is Billy still going to talk to me? It's been a while since I've reached out to him. It's kind of like your mother if you don't call her after a while or something. And it took some warming up. Billy was a bit miffed. I hadn't checked in a while, but we had some very interesting conversations. And again, I'll have them out loud. It's a great way to be left alone by your family. They either think you're going a little crazy or they know you're serious on a new book. And the other thing I try to keep in mind is what the old Annie Lamont line, you've got to let bad things happen to good people, or else you don't have much of a story. And I love my characters. I mean, you know, there's several I've kind of lost or had to write out of the story over the course of both novels. And when I have, again, my poor suffering family, they know it. You know, I'm down in the dumps. You know, somebody's, you know, no longer in my life, and I'm feeling kind of heartbroken about it. So I think it's having conversations with your characters, because when the characters take over a story, that's where it starts to take off. Earlier in my career, I used to fight that. How dare they? I outlined this. I diagrammed this. This is my story. And now, when they start to take it over, I just go, you go. You know it better than me.
And do you find when you're at a traffic light and people are looking at you when you're talking to your characters that you have to pretend that you're on the phone? I find that that happens to me all the time. I'll be having a conversation between two characters, and I'll be driving somewhere, and I'll look over, and there'll be people looking at me like, is this guy demented? So I automatically pick up my phone as if I was talking on the phone. Now, the other thing about your characters that I really like, and you said this, bad things happen to good people, and sometimes with the best of intentions, almost as the characters, this is something I've always believed is great, have just enough information to make a bad decision.
Oh, very much. And the thing is, I don't think any, even, I don't know, the villains or even the evil characters in the story, you know, they have, I don't want to say some justification, but they've got some motivation. And that's important to me. I need to know whether it's Billy Bryan or his daughters like Evangelina or Cassie or his good friend Chuck Cochran or even Fidel Castro. What what is their motivation in this particular world I've brought them in? And as long as it's human and heartfelt and authentic, I think it plays. I may not disagree with it, you know, from a human being standpoint myself, but if Billy Bryan says this is important and I need to do this, then all right, we're going to give it a shot.
We're talking with Tim Wendel about his new book, Escape from Castro's Cuba. Tim, how did the conversation with Billy change this time around for you, with him being at a very different place of his life and now going back to Cuba, not for baseball, but to make a movie?
Yeah, he didn't want to go. I said, Billy, we need to go again. And there was some, you know, there's always some familiarity with it. This all kind of got the sequel got its genesis off a 2017 trip that I took down. And I was maybe a little ambivalent, but my wife very much wanted to go to Cuba. You know, it's like, hang on, you've been three times, you know, already to that point. You know, it's about time you took me. And you know, she's traveled all around the world. She's more savvy than me. But there's something about Cuba. And it's not to say it's, you know, dangerous necessarily, but it can put you a little bit on edge. And from the get-go, things were just unrolling. You know, things were, you know, somewhat out of control. Before we even cleared customs, a Cuban plain clothesman slipped in alongside of me as we're crossing the tarmac, and I could tell, you know, he was security, even though he was dressed in dungarees and a T-shirt. And he said, call me Ricky. And I went, okay. And I said, hi, Ricky. And I didn't give him my name. And we walked a little bit farther. And then he said, what brings you back to Cuba again, Senior Wendel? And I went, oh, my goodness. I haven't cleared customs, and they know I'm back. And that's Havana. You're never quite sure where you stack up.
Right. Now, did you also get, like, Billy postcards from Cuba saying your friends miss you?
I didn't get as many as Billy did, but but I did run into some real life friends down there, and they did miss me, and they went out of their way to point out, in essence, how much, you know, Cuba's a strange place because certain things stay the same. You know, it's almost like, I don't know, going back to your old high school or something, but other things can change markedly. And what several of these real life friends in Havana pointed out to me very quickly was the days of somebody like El Duque Hernandez, you know, who pitched for so many, you know, great years with the Yankees and the playoffs, etc. The years of players getting out, defecting on rafts are over. You know, they're still getting out, but now they're getting out on cigarette boats, probably with the help of crime syndicates, probably out of Mexico. And that really got me thinking. I was going, wow, they've traded one very dangerous situation for another. And that really got me thinking about the world of Cuba right now.
About 30 years ago, I read a book called Baseball in the Cold War. And I think the second part of it is The Necessity of Baseball in the Life of a Serious Student of Hegel and Marx by Howard Senzel. That took the position that the last Havana Kings game with the spent bullet and the Yankees and someone being hit was really a turning point in the history of sport that people don't see its importance. That broke our, in a sense, broke the link to Cuba and baseball. Is that an overblown assertion?
No, I don't think so. Because, again, we've got this shared love. You know, and one of them's baseball, another's music, etc. I mean, there's many ties that bind. And one of the things I do, guys, when I go down is I try to bring a number of ball caps, and I also bring a number of baseballs. Because you still see kids playing ball in the streets. It's like, I don't know, the Bronx or something, you know, back when Willie Mays was playing for the New York Giants or something. And it never fails. You know, I'll have a number of these in my backpack, you know, new baseballs, and I'll see some kids playing in the street, and I'll watch them for a bit, talk to them, and then I'll reach into my backpack and give them, and they've probably been playing with, I don't know, duct tape rolled up to make a ball or, you know, a piece of bark or something, and I'll hand them a bona fide baseball. And the look on their faces is, I could have given them the Hope Diamond. You know, I've like fallen out of the blue and given them what they have dreamed about. And what people need to remember, too, is the old Winter Ball League, where a lot of the first novel takes place, Castro's Curveball, that Winter Ball League was only maybe a half step below the major leagues. I mean, that was rarefied air in terms of minor league ball. I mean, Willie Mays played there, Brooks Robinson played there, Tommy Lasorda, Jim Bunning, you know, and that's just the Americanos. I mean, the number of guys like Tony Perez and Martin Diego, Adolph Luque, you know, the great Cuban players coming out of there was also pretty amazing, too. So there's our shared past. There's our shared history, and every now and then when you give a baseball to a kid, you know, you tap into it again.
Well, you really brought Cuba to life for someone who hasn't been there. I certainly was able to visualize it, and I found the whole book to be, I guess I would say, very cinematic. I would think some smart producer would pick up on this and try and option the rights to that book.
Well, we can hope. It's an option. There's a couple of meetings I got to bring you guys into. I mean, you're doing a better job of pitching this than me, but it is a very cinematic country, and Havana certainly is a city like that. I mean, I can close my eyes right now and think of, you know, some major boulevards and such in Havana. You know, the way the light falls at dusk and the royal palm trees down the middle of the boulevards that have pretty much probably been around since the conquistador days, etc. And I think that's, again, something that, you know, people have responded to. And I've been lucky at times. A number of my grad school teachers at Hopkins and elsewhere have really pushed that. And one of the things they said, you know, early on when I was starting to do fiction, they said, you know, when you're writing works, at that point it wasn't working that much. They said, I can see it, and I can picture it. And it goes back maybe to, in some ways, to that old Joseph Conrad line who wrote, what, Heart of Darkness, and et cetera. And somebody asked him one time, what's the key to quality writing? And he said, if you can make me see, in a sense, what I'm seeing in my head, can you describe it well enough so I can see it in my head? And when those rare times it works, maybe we're doing that too.
Well, you certainly did that with a raft of great characters, and Raft was not meant to be a pun. It just struck me at the moment. A great list of characters, but and the setting becomes a character itself. People really should read this, Escape from Castro's Cuba. It's one of the most enjoyable baseball novels that Rich and I have read in a long time, and we read a lot of sports books, at least one every week, sometimes two and three. The pace was great, the story was great, and I can't wait to read Castro's Curveball, and we can talk to you again.
Oh, I'd love to be on. Yeah, that's a fun time.
Great. Well, Tim, thank you so much for being with us today, and we will definitely reach out again down the road.
I look forward to it, guys. Have a great evening. Have a great Memorial Day weekend, too.
Thanks, you too. That's Tim Wendell. The book is called...